Guitar people, welcome to Have Guitar Wheel Travel, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. With your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with guitarist Marcus Demmel. In our conversation, Marcus talks about his physical journey as a child from the former Czech Republic to Austria and to Germany, Hamburg being his current home in the forest, which also houses a studio. Marcus describes his gear in detail and talks about his friendship with fellow German Reinhold Bogner, whom he met while attending GIT in Hollywood. Marcus is partially responsible for helping Bogner design the Ecstasy. Marcus takes us through his musical history, starting on jazz, studying in Munich, before moving to Hollywood to attend Musicians Institute, and Marcus tells us why he chose MI and his goal of becoming a session guitarist. Marcus describes the culture shock of moving to Hollywood at 20 after growing up in Europe, and talks about his return to Europe after 7 years of working doing sessions and teaching at MI, as well as playing in the inevitable hair bands of the 80s. Marcus tells us about how he started doing sessions in Europe, and Marcus tells us about becoming a brand, making pedals, doing clinics, running his own label, doing YouTube demos, and making his own music. His current album is called Pure. Marcus talks about his guitar heroes, particularly Gary Moore, and Marcus discusses the financial aspects of touring and playing live and doing workshops. To find out more about Marcus, you can go to his website, marcusdemmel.com. That's MarcusDemmel.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my buddy Marcus.
Hey there, Marcus.
There you are. How are you? Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's an interesting place you're sitting at. What is that, a studio or is that your office?
It is what was known as the Woodshed. And I have a band and this is where we rehearse, but it's also where I teach lessons here and all kinds of stuff. And what you're not seeing is that is what's behind us. So like if I turn it here, you just see a mass of amplifiers, basically amplifiers.
Wonderful.
Roll out when we're rehearsing.
Cool. So what's the name of the band?
The Deadlies.
The Deadlies?
Yes. it's like a surf band, for lack of a better
term. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And where are you at your own studio?
I'm at home. The studio is downstairs.
Okay.
And I basically moved. I'm a Czech guy living in Germany and in Hamburg now. Uh-huh. And I bought a house here about 10 years ago. It's in the woods, so I don't really have any neighbors.
Uh-huh.
And I'm this much soundproof material.
Sure.
Downstairs, so I can crank any of the 15 tube amps that are waiting down there for me all the time.
And so you say 50 tube amps. What kind of amps do you have? Is it Marshall
15,
heavy?
Not 50. Yeah. No, I'm down to 3 Marshalls, actually.
Oh, wow.
Just the 3 major foot groups, the non-master volume ones, the 1987, the 50-watt, the Super Elite. They're both reissues, and a 69 Super Bass.
Okay. Right on.
So and a 65 Bandmaster and a bunch of custom amps and an old Bogner Fish preamp.
Wow.
Boogie stuff. There's an 80s rack down there too.
A Bradshaw rack or?
No. It's all apart, but it's like a Boogie power amp with some kind of strange switching system. I just actually fixed the Bogner and the Boogie 290 about 3-4 months ago. Because I haven't used it since my session days, which were basically over 20 years ago.
Oh my goodness!
Right. but I was surprised how great it sounds.
Yeah.
If you don't put it to all the processing shit, the Bogner is a killer, and the Boogie 290 is a killer too.
Wow.
I have to say that it's the only problem, you can't lift it and. You know, I mean, it's, I think it's like 50 kilograms. So what's that, a little bit more than 100 American pounds. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a Bogner Ecstasy 101B and that I got maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah. I was partially responsible for designing these amps.
So, were you really?
Yeah, because I didn't know it at the time, but Reinhold and I, we were the best friends in our L.A. time. Well, he's still in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And so he always invited me over. He goes, I'm working on this new amp. Can you give me your feedback? So I was sitting there, less low end, less compression, more gain, more treble,
yeah,
more 1.5K. So, and yeah, and the Bogner that I have is actually, I think it was a pay from a NAMM show 300 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Serial number 42.
Wow. All right. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So let me get a little bit of your history, your musical history. Did you, grew up in Prague, or did you, when did you move from Prague?
As a little baby, because the Russians invaded.
Oh.
So it's the Prague Spring, as they say. But my parents, you sort of could smell it. So they escaped a few weeks earlier to Austria.
Okay.
Because my grandma is Austrian.
Okay.
Was Austrian, and she was a grand dame of the classical music scene in Salzburg.
Okay.
Which so I always had to, and she had a big hotel in Salzburg. So that was my first musical influence. And then we moved already to Munich and a bunch of other cities. And I stayed in Germany till I was 20. And then I moved to LA.
Okay.
For MI.
Yeah.
So that's the very short one, but it's like, you know, four countries in the first 20-25 years.
Yeah, yeah. So just for my own sense of geography, how far is it from Prague to Salzburg?
Not far, like to a few hours to 3 hours. Okay. Drive.
And then from Salzburg to Hamburg, where is it? You're in Hamburg.
No, that's a long drive. That's a 10-hour drive.
Okay.
But before that, I actually was socialized and started play in Frankfurt.
Okay.
Frankfurt is in the middle of Germany, basically.
All right.
So in the middle of Salzburg, Munich, and Hamburg is far north.
Okay. All right.
So, Frankfurt had a great jazz and blues scene at the time when I started to play. So there was amazing jazz musicians coming out of Frankfurt. So I started to play jazz when I was 12, 13 years old. What else would you do? Of course, if you're a foreigner, if you're a freckled red-haired foreigner in Germany, what else would you do? try to play bebop and listen to Joe Pass and, yeah, you know, that kind of thing.
Was guitar always your instrument? Did you play anything?
Yes.
Before? Okay.
No, I never, I only try like I dabble with it like a three-year-old. On the piano, there's actually one tune that I actually wrote on a piano, but I cannot play the piano. I was like, okay, that's a D minor 7-9. Oh, here's the 11th. So I know the theory. So and then I do it with the computer, bar per bar.
Sure.
And I play the demo bass always on my records, mm-hmm, of course.
Yeah.
And I program the drums, and I'm pretty good with the computer, with Logic Audio.
Yeah, right on.
So that's my instrument. I think if there would, it wouldn't be for Logic Audio, I would have would be better with other instruments. Mm. But life is short.
Yes, exactly. So did you go to music school in Europe before coming to LA?
I had private teachers. I got very serious when I was 14.
Okay.
I was like, that's it. I'm going to be a guitar player.
Yeah.
And, but everybody, since I'm not only white, but old, I have, everybody was playing guitar in my class. And I had lots of great musicians, piano players, saxophone players. It's not like today.
Yeah.
You know? And they actually, most of them became professional musicians.
Wow.
People I went to school with.
Okay.
You know? And, So I started to take private lessons when I was 15.
Uh-huh.
And I went to a jazz school for like 6 months before I went to MI. So I studied jazz theory, uh-huh, actually, because I thought I had to.
Yeah. Well, it probably
and all hurt. The I don't know. I really, first I started to, you know, play blues and blues rock.
Yeah.
Like Hendrix, Johnny Winter, Gallagher or Gallagher, as an Irish person would say.
Sure, sure.
And the BB King, that kind of thing. But it's quickly morphed into the jazz and fusion thing because my best friend was a saxophone player.
Okay.
He said, you have to listen to Charlie Parker. So, but the advantage was that when I went to MI, I was theory-wise, I was ahead of most of the guys, most of the long-haired dudes. I was like, yeah, I know what a Lydian scale is. And they're like, dude.
So why MI? Berkeley has a European sort of satellite school. Why not do Berkeley over there? And why did you pick MI out of all the opportunities that you had?
I started to read Guitar Player magazine when I was about 15.
Okay.
I still have my first issue with Holdsworth on the cover.
Sure, sure, sure.
And they had the better marketing. And so one day I actually sent them like $3 to send me a brochure.
Yeah.
And they had Steve Morse, Eddie Van Halen, and all these great, and Holdsworth and everybody in their catalogs. So they made it seem like you had private lessons with Holdsworth, of course. But a lot of my favorite guitar players came out of LA. And I actually at that time, so that's I'm 19, 20 years old, I had the goal to become a session player. And I already started that a little bit in Germany. And so I thought, okay, of course, you like Mike Landau, you like Michael Thompson, Luke Gather, of course, go to LA. It's sunny. It's beautiful. Yeah. So that was the reason.
Okay. And were you aware of Berkeley?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yes, I was. But, you know, I think it was even more expensive than MI. And MI was already pretty expensive. Yeah. I had to take a loan from my parents and, you know, and with the immigration, you had to put down a deposit of a lot of money, which was like...
Yeah, had you
but
been...
But I wanted... Excuse me. I wanted to just really go to a guitar school.
Yeah.
Focus. I wasn't very smart. I was just... A focused nerd.
I would argue as a person that went to Berkeley, I think you made the better choice.
Okay.
And had you been to LA or Hollywood before that?
No. It was like somebody beamed me to fucking Mars.
Yeah.
It was culture shock. Jesus Christ. Cab driver ripped me off. First thing that happened to me. I was just for 3 days. I stayed for 3 days in the Holiday Inn and I had to get a room. It was a culture shock, but I mean, I had the school. I knew I wanted to do music like 12 hours a day. And so I did that for 2 years, which was fantastic.
Sure,
I didn't even
sure,
have
sure.
a car. I didn't even in LA. I mean, I didn't have a car. I didn't have the money for it. I just had two Strats, a pair of jeans and a distortion box. That was it.
Yeah. And I should ask you, so when you got serious at 15, what was your guitar? What was the guitar that you were playing at that point?
It was called a CG Winner. It was a Japanese neck through body mahogany kind of, those kind of wooden design double cutaway things. It probably wasn't bad, you know, with some kind of two fake DiMarzio super distortions in there. But my very first good guitar, which I bought for $500, which I have to thank my parents again because they didn't really support my behaviors, but they whenever I said I need a good guitar and I can get an Ibanez Artist for $500, which was like less than half price of what it was. So it was a 1981 Artist 300.
Oh, right on. That's a nice guitar.
Which I sold before I went to LA because I needed the money, but I just bought exact the same year, same model, like 4 or 5 years ago. I actually have three now of them, of these vintage Ibanez guitars.
Okay.
The Artists.
Yeah,
it's just sentimental value.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, they're like a tank, but they're very good guitars. I have the double neck version, a 78.
Oh, wow.
And I have a 79, which is super cool, yeah. And an 81, which is like sort of like a Les Paul.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always lusted after the double necks. I thought those were the coolest things ever.
15 pounds.
So you don't play those out a lot?
No. I had the double neck. I've owned the double neck now for 20 years. Uh-huh. A friend in a drunken state gave me the guitar, actually, one day. I was with Yamaha Guitars at that time. He was my product manager, and we were drinking beer and doing stupid stuff. And he goes, I have one of these terrible artist guitars underneath my bed for the last 10 years. And he gave me the guitar. He regretted it probably, but he gave it to me, you know. Yeah. Hold on.
Oh, he's going to pick it up. Oh, my God. Oh, it's beautiful, though. Look at that thing. That's gorgeous.
Plus, changing strings on a 12-string is a lot of joy.
It could be a Gretsch. Oh. With a Bigsby.
Yeah.
When you showed up with two Strats at MI?
Yeah, two 280 Strats. Okay. I was, you know, I'm from the Eddie Van Halen school, so yeah. you buy a guitar and you take the chisel. I still do that, unfortunately. Okay. I've ruined a lot of guitars. You know, it was just understood that you do that.
Sure.
But I got my first real Fender Strat. Actually, I won at a Guitar Center contest in, like, I don't know, late 80s or something. And I traded that guitar for one of my main, or actually probably the most important guitar that I still own. It's a 57 reissue, a black one.
Uh-huh.
That I play most of the time. I really play only two guitars, the black reissue from 87.
Uh-huh.
Which I got when it was almost brand new.
Yep.
And a white 63. So those are my main guitars. I have another 63, a red one. And I even have some vintage Gibsons, like a 56 Les Paul. And I just bought a Firebird.
Oh, right on.
A white Firebird Bicentennial from a 76.
Yeah.
Which is super cool. It's just, but I'm a Strat guy, you know. I have an old, wonderful 66 335.
Wow.
Which looks exactly like Larry Carlton's. I always thought it's a 69 because they gave the serial number away twice. But now the Gibson nerd said, you're wrong. You said it's a 69. It's a 66. You can see because of the way the horns are shaped. I go, okay, sorry. but when I'm serious, it's really the white 63 and the 57 reissue.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Which are the ones in the videos too.
Sure.
Most of my videos.
Yeah. After graduating MI, did you stay in LA?
Yeah. I stayed there for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
I only left because I didn't get a work permit.
Oh, wow.
They just would. They immediately after the first year, Keith Wyatt, the blues instructor, called me and said, would you like to work at MI? I go, yes, everything's going right. I can stay here. And I thought, well, I'm just going to, you know, go with the job offer to the immigration office. And they go, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
No. They want money. You have to get a lawyer.
Yeah.
The lawyer said, which was in 1988 or something, you need $5,000. I said, $5,000?
Damn.
For a 20-year-old kid, you know, it's with I was living of like $20 a week or something, you know. My rent was $300 or something. And I actually was teaching illegally sometimes at MI. So whenever one of the instructors, which the instructors were all super cool and super nice to me, they called me up and said, Marcus, I have a gig. Can you do my open counseling from 2 to 5 or whatever?
Yeah.
So that was that. But I didn't get the work permit, which was a bummer. And so I prolonged my student visa. Went another year to MI, which I didn't really go there that much anymore. Uh-huh. But it was like $500 for 6 months.
Okay.
It was super cheap.
Yeah.
And I was gigging around town, teaching a little bit.
Yeah.
And I had two or three studios where I was like the demo king, you know.
Uh-huh.
Here, take this guy from Germany. You know, 50 bucks a day. It's great. So that's what I did.
And you were in Hollywood, you know, basically at the peak of the hair band era. Did you dabble with the hair band stuff, or was it?
Yeah, we had actually. I was in a band which was supposed to become the next Guns N' Roses. We even had the same management.
Oh wow!
And we were already driving around in limos because we were recording. We had a development deal at A&M, which is now Henson Studios on La Brea. So, you know, I was 22 and you go to these huge studios and you say, hey, I'm Marcus. I'm supposed to play guitar here. You're in studio B. Brian Adams is in A. Sting is in C, you know? And so we knew we were the next big thing, of course.
Sure.
And for various reasons, actually it didn't work out, which was probably good for my well-being.
Yes. Yeah. Especially after the demise of the hair band scene.
I mean, it's just the lifestyle. I mean, you know, the lifestyle. I was never that much into drugs and everything, but it was all there. It was Sodom all the way. You know, girls, shady people, drugs and alcohol, which I'm glad I was still smart enough to, you know, to always step back. But who knows what would have happened if, you know, if we'd gotten to the big time.
Yeah. And you mentioned Eddie Van Halen. Did you, when you were in Europe, did you ever see him play over there?
No.
I
actually went once to a concert in the late 90s and it got canceled Alex Van Halen injured his neck.
Oh wow!
No, I actually stood in front, and they were not really big. It was like a 800 seater.
Oh wow!
Here in Hamburg.
Oh man!
So Van Halen was not big at all at that time. It was with Sharon, Halen 3 thing. But of course, I wanted to see Eddie, and I was really bummed out.
Yeah.
But I never.
Oh, wow.
And once when I was supposed to go on the very first tour, but I was like 12 or 11 years old, and my parents wouldn't let me, and my other friends went though.
Yeah.
So that's a bummer. That's a bummer.
Did you have an opportunity to see live music when you were back in Germany?
Every day. It was the music scene was fantastic in the 80s.
Okay.
in Frankfurt. There was a club called Zinkasten, which was actually called Zoom, and even Hendrix played there. I'm too young to see Hendrix, but I saw a lot of great bands and American bands. It was like a club for like max 500 people.
Oh wow.
I even played there myself probably 20 or 30 times.
Oh,
I saw Larry Coryell there. I saw Buddy Guy there. That was like my first real blues show.
Yeah.
Which I thought as a 14-year-old it just really took me somewhere. And they had everything from smashing rock to bebop. I saw Elvin Jones.
I saw
all these people, and you had the option to have a monthly card for like $30, and you could go every night, and they had concerts 6 nights a week.
Wow.
Within walking distance. So yeah. I sometimes saw, I don't know, 15 concerts a month.
Yeah. But it says something about your musicality that you would have the foresight to go see Larry Coryell or Elvin Jones at a young age.
I did. I never understood the stylistic restrictions. So I'm only a rocker. I'm only a country player. I'm a jazz head. I said, this is, I mean, if something happens here, I don't care if you play a Polish polka, you know, I don't care, you know.
That's great. That's fantastic. When did you encounter Reinhold?
On his very first day in Hollywood. At the back alley cafe, he says there's this tall, skinny guy looking kind of shady coming. Says, are you from Germany? I says, sort of. I'm not really German, but. Yeah. says, I need a place to stay. I have no money. I said, who is this guy? You know? So I think he crashed like 2 or 3 nights, but then he annoyed somebody else. He was pretty messy at that time. And he had a quality that I always admired, which is the reason why he broke into the business. He had nothing to lose, and he was fairly shameless. I was always a little bit shy. So you play guitar, yeah, a little bit, you know. Yeah. And Reinhold, he was, for example, he said, "Yeah, Gary Moore just tried out my amp."
Wow!
How did you do that? I went to the sound check, sneaked in, and held up my amp till he stopped. And then he tried it. So that's Reinhold for you. Yeah.
So he was already tinkering with amps at that point when you first met him?
He brought and modified JCM 800.
Okay.
That was the only amp. And I think about 4 weeks later, he got a contract with Andy Brower.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So they hired him. They basically ripped him off, but they paid for his apartment and paid him like enough money to stay alive.
Yeah.
But he was just, you know, very courageous. Mm-hmm. I had hardly anybody, but he had like nothing. He literally came with that JCM 800 and like $300 and asked people if he could crash on the couch.
Wow.
Which gave him that killer instinct, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure, for sure. When you were in LA, you're doing studio stuff and then you have to leave. Did you immediately start doing studio stuff when you came back to Germany?
The thing was, I wasn't in a very good state when I left LA. I had a crazy girlfriend who was doing stupid stuff. And one of my best friends, Matthias Hoffman, he was like my guitar playing best friend in Frankfurt. Uh-huh. At that time, he had a record company for ambient music, techno and electro and ambient music, which was in the mid-90s, super popular all over Europe. Uh-huh. And he said, "Marcus, you look like shit. And you know what? I think you need to clear your head, and here's a plane ticket." So he took me to Germany. Uh-huh. And 3 days later, he put me in a studio with the famous co-producer of the Ralf Hildenbeutel, who's a very, now he's a big film composer. He said, "You know what? I have this concept. We take your annoying guitar playing and combine it with ambient and techno music."
Oh, wow.
And so we worked on a record called, the project was called Earth Nation. And we worked on it for 3 months. And it actually is probably my biggest record, because it was even in at least the remixes and everything was in the dance charts. Wow. All over Europe. The first gig was at the Montreux Jazz Festival at the Miles Davis Hall, because we took it with the whole band on stage.
Wow.
So, and also at the same time, which was very funny, another producer in that record company, IQ Records, it was called, said, "I really like your playing. I know another studio here, about half an hour drive, and they do all these big pop records. And here's a production. There's this German superstar at the time, Nena, which she had sure. a hit in the States.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
They just fired the guitar players. Could you do the record?" So I did. I did do the record, and so that's all within like the first few weeks in Germany.
Wow.
And I started to make this ridiculous money, and I'm working like 30 every day. And the second record I did was after the Nena thing was with the Toto singer Bobby Kimball.
Sure, sure.
So and it just went crazy for like 2 years. I was pretty busy almost every day.
Yeah. Did you lose the crazy girlfriend?
Yes. She stayed in LA.
Oh, okay.
she stayed in LA, and it was good. It was good. I had to actually move in back with my parents.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I was completely broke.
Yeah.
Skinny as a rail. Uh-huh. I didn't look good at all. And but suddenly, within a few weeks, I'm just working, and I started to work with people from LA. You know, so that was just completely crazy.
Yeah. And how about now? Now, are you doing much studio work?
Hardly at all. And if so, people just sent me the files.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, I have, it's a small studio, but it's well equipped with everything.
Sure.
From not only the amps, but API preamps and fine pieces of gear.
Yeah.
And so I've been pretty much doing my home recording for 20 years. Yeah. And they just send me the files and tell me what they want and they get it. But I maybe do, I don't know, 7-8 sessions a year. It's yeah. nothing. And I used to do 7-8 sessions in 2 days sometimes.
And so mostly you're just working on your own music?
Yeah, it's really, as my current girlfriend would say, I'm a brand now. So I have my own record company. Triple Coil Music is my own record company.
Okay.
I make my own pedals, the Sweet Elephant Overdrive and its Angry Gorilla Distortion, which I only made, or my technicians made them. I designed them. I said, you know, I tell them about frequency, gain, and compression ratio, blah, 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 blah. And then we fiddle. And after 2 years, I'm like, this is the greatest pedal ever. And she goes, why don't you sell it? Okay, so I'm doing that. I'm doing on my own guitar clinics. Till about 3 years ago, I was even I had a lady working for me doing my own booking.
Wow!
But so it's all picks, all my signature products, pickups, picks, T-shirts, blah blah blah. So the record, the marketing, everything. So days are long.
Yes.
Days are long.
Sure they are. And is that how you encountered Josh?
I just contacted him because I know Michael Molenda, the old chief editor from Guitar Player magazine.
Sure.
And I just asked him.
Yeah.
Who's who would you recommend as a publicist?
Yeah. There you go.
So that's and he says this guy's he's at least. You can trust him.
Yeah.
That's the most important
thing. Josh is the best. I think Josh is the best. So that's my own opinion. So, and you're doing demos too, right? You're doing YouTube demos?
Yes, but mostly for my own stuff, and it's just an excuse to play a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're great. Yeah. They're fantastic.
Thank you. I'm trying to get better, you know. Now I started in 4K, so I'm not, and I just got...
That's a lot of K's.
It's a lot of case, you know, and I'm trying, and you know, it's just the best thing, and it's also good for me because
sure.
I double check my playing,
yeah,
and all the time. He said, "You think that take was great?" And here, wow, I'm flat in bar 16.
Yeah,
whatever, you know. Yeah, I do that too. So I dabble with editing now, and a lot of companies have approached me to demo their stuff, but I haven't said yes yet.
Oh wow, yeah. And what's the so? Well, let's ask him. Let me ask you about your current album, Pure. First off, it's fantastic. The playing is stellar. You mentioned Eddie Van Halen, but and Josh. You know, said something about Jeff Beck. Was Jeff Beck one of your guys early on?
No, actually not. It was when I was a fusion player, the snotty aristocrat fusion player when I was 16, there was a German live concert on TV with Gary Moore. And it was the time, the hard rock phase from Gary Moore. And
sure.
he was playing a 61 Fiesta Red
yes.
with seven Marshalls. and actually, I didn't know it at the time, but he was channeling a lot of Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
So that's, I think that what people refer to now as a Beck influence, I stole that from Gary Moore.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but of course, Jeff Beck was great.
Yeah.
I've heard him. I even saw him live with Stevie Ray.
Okay.
And has on the last Stevie Ray tour, the 1990 or Guitar Shop tour, it was. Yeah. And I actually was supposed to go on tour with him by the late of the 90s, and Mr. Beck said that I'm too good, which was which was great and annoying at the same time because we were already rehearsing for the tour.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but because the very first a solo record that I did was called Arrowhead, even though it's a band name. Uh-huh. I had a fairly big record company, and they put out all the money, and so finally they arranged it so I can do at least, I think, like 10 or 15 dates in Europe with Mr. Beck, and it was all exciting. But he said no, and he said, somewhere I have the facts. Jeff doesn't like the competitive aspect of the billing, was the which at this point, since I'm more professional now, I can totally understand, because you just kill the audience with two instrumental guitar players.
Yeah.
And he was smart enough, which I would do now, to have a rockabilly band as an opener.
Yeah.
No, I could just Gene Vincent and the Blue Flames kind of thing, which he was, you know, he was a Cliff Gallup fan, like who wouldn't be? And so at that time it was super disappointing. I was just like, I was young and full of power, and this record company's putting all this ridiculous money into.
And the players that are playing with you on Pure, who are they?
Felix Demler is it's not my son. He's not. He's just a very good drummer that I've known since he's 15 years old. He was actually the son of my lawyer, who took guitar lessons at one point from me.
Okay.
And I played with him 5 years in a blues rock band called the Blue Poets, which was the project that I had before.
Okay.
So, Achim Raphaim, he's like a pretty well-known session guy. You know, it's sort of like if this would be Nashville, he would be on the top level. He just, Achim, play John Patitucci, okay, whatever, you know, or just play. He's just amazing.
Yeah.
And I was after him for about 20 years. He always said no. I don't know if he didn't like me, but then he said yes. And Tom Eschbacher, Swiss guy, is the only keyboard player I know.
Okay.
No, but he's played. I had a fusion band that was actually very successful in Japan called Electric Outlet, where I sort of channel my inner Holdsworth.
Yep.
So that was sort of his baby. It was like, you know, Billy Cobham, Return to Forever kind of early Jeff Beck kind of vibe thing, or Tommy Bolin, whatever that. So recorded live in the studio for four good musicians, or three good musicians and me, and that was actually it was quite successful in Japan over there. It's Electric Outlet On is the record.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are the guys. I've known them all for ages because you know, this is like album number 13, 14, and I'm just the experience that I have is you have to get along.
Oh yeah, that's a fact.
I just don't want any funny people around me anymore.
Yeah.
I don't want any energy killers or especially with singers. It was always, oh, I don't want to sing today. Oh, I don't feel like that. Oh, no.
Have you ever tried singing yourself?
Yes. All the vocal stuff from Arrowhead and the Blue Poets. I usually work like this, just like I worked on Pure. I record the whole album myself.
Oh, okay.
So everything is ready. It's just not as good,
of course,
because I play everything, I mix it, I master it. But it's sort of I have a vision where it's going.
Yeah.
And so I sing I sort of sing like my girlfriend says I sound like Kurt Cobain, which is a great compliment.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, but I need 25 takes to get it. So I think it's a confidence thing. I'm just not confident enough to. I had to sing a Hendrix show once.
Oh, wow.
That was interesting. But I tuned down, yeah. Tuned down almost the whole... I went to the Band of Gypsies tuning, which was almost a whole step.
Yeah. And how about playing live? Do you guys go out and play?
Yes. Well, this is like the second Marcus demo album. We did about 15 shows, not that much. We played 2 shows in 3 weeks.
Okay.
And see how it goes. Right now, it's even though I shouldn't say that, it's all about the money.
Yeah.
Live playing just doesn't pay that much anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm so lucky that I have a business that really works. I mean, I play this silly guitar music with no artistic compromises, and I make a living, which implies that I have to do a lot of office work.
Yeah.
I'm the record company. I'm the cigar smoking, I'm the cigar smoking, suit wearing Italian guy. Hey, is it any good? Hey, Gino. We play if they pay enough. Yeah. Like, for example, in Switzerland and Liechtenstein, which is, we have to drive for that 10, 12 hours.
Yeah, that's far.
They pay.
Uh-huh.
They you go, okay, we can have 2 travel days. It's good.
Yeah.
And I can pay the guys because I just don't want to go, here's 200 bucks. But we travel a week, okay? Is that okay? I just they're all grown up men.
Yes.
And but if there's a, of course, the vision is to play, for example, with that kind of music, the bigger jazz festivals.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who shows respect.
Sure.
Because we practice, we put on a perfect show. It's everybody is totally focused. But I have my expectations on the other side too.
Yeah, I totally get it. And how about workshops? How often are you doing workshops?
I do my own 3 times a year.
Okay.
There's always one spring, summer, winter. And sometimes I actually used to do a lot for guitar companies or music schools. Uh-huh. and conservatories, or for Fender guitars. I did once even a European tour.
Okay.
And whatever, if it works out and I can play my music and it's artistically, if it's artistically correct,
yeah,
I do it.
Yeah. And do you still go to NAMM or Music Mess or anything like that?
Sometimes. I've actually, the last time I went was 2 or 3 years ago. I played at the Guitar Summit.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
So this is now the big thing in Europe. But if somebody invites me to the NAMM show, I would be there because I have a lot of listeners from America.
Sure.
I think about 35% of my listeners are from the States.
Okay.
So it's actually a bigger market for me than Germany.
Yeah. And how about Japan?
Not as much, only about 5. Google Analytics says only about 5%. I even think the Italians like me better, and the French guys, so I look at that and I see that, because right now here we're in the office, it's such a mess. It's like a post office.
Uh-huh.
The album is not even out. Release date is November 7. We sold 1500 physical copies.
Wow.
So, which is amazing, because I don't do the Spotify thing anymore because I just can't afford it.
Yeah.
So I'm here with it in the mom and pop store. We're just packing and signing and T-shirts and picks and pickups and everything. Yeah. And it's good.
Yeah, very good. You're in Hamburg right now, correct?
Right.
Is there a vintage guitar store in Hamburg?
Yes.
Oh, there is.
Number one guitar. Okay. Yeah, I go there sometimes to, we have 3 bursts. Yeah, okay, I'll be there. And you find out, I'm not sure if I should say that only one of them is great.
Yeah. It's true. That's true.
Yeah, I got yelled at online because I said in one Guitar Junkie video where he goes, you need a proper setup. If your 59 verse is not set up properly, it's not going to sound any good. And somebody got so upset with me. It's, you know, no, every 59 is great. Yeah. Nice. And yeah, there's a, there, and in Frank, in the Frankfurt area, of course, you have the, not, what is it called? Forgot the name. Oh, Jesus Christ. I even played there. Guitar Point.
Okay.
But that's Frankfurt. But here it's number one. Number one is a smaller kind of store. It's not like the Guitar Center kind of thing. Uh-huh. And they have a vintage room. Okay. So, and, you know, like, Marcus, we have a 54 Strat.
Yeah.
Serial number 27. First owner.
And what about, like, I don't know what the equivalent of Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace is over there, but are there people, like, just individuals selling, like, vintage gear?
I'm not really in the market anymore. And all the guitars, I have about 50 guitars.
Okay.
But I never actively went out and says, I'm going to buy a so-and-so guitar.
Yeah.
It's always, I am somewhere and somebody goes, well, I have an old Strat.
Yeah.
Like the Firebird. It's the first time I've been living here in these beautiful Hamburg woods, and there's only one bar within like 15 minutes walking distance. Uh-huh. For the first time, I walk in there and there's a blues band playing, and I'm walking out with a 76 Firebird.
Wow.
We made the deal. We made the deal after the second beer. So that's how I buy guitars. Actually, none of my guitars are store-bought.
Okay.
None of them.
Mm-hmm.
No, because, I mean, I never paid more than custom shop prices for my vintage guitars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I bought the 335 at a gas station for $3,000.
Wow, right on.
Because a friend of a friend said, I'm selling this old 335. You want it? I need money.
Yeah.
Okay, let me take a look at it. At the gas station, about an hour drive from here, I'm playing a G chord. I said, I'd take it.
That's great.
So because, I mean, the prices are, I think they're, I mean, of course, it's the demand. The demand is there. And if money is not an object, of course, you can spend $400,000 on a guitar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But for $400,000, I would build a studio like,
oh, yeah,
Ocean's Way.
Sure, 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 sure. And so apart from all the music stuff, what do you do? What do you do to relax? What do you do to have for fun?
Guitar playing.
Okay.
No, it's my days are really 14 hours.
Okay.
So I get up every day at 8 o'clock. Right now, it's not much fun really, because I never wanted to work 6-7 hours in the office.
Yeah.
And it's not what I wanted to do. I jog, or I go for a long walk, because it's just a beautiful nature resort where I live.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I live in a vintage house.
Okay.
I live in a vintage house which needs as more maintenance than any pre-CBS Strat. Something's wrong with the water tank. Okay, I'm coming.
Yeah.
So I try to read every once in a while, you know, and I try to stay off TV or Netflix.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. But usually it's about 10:30 at night, and I just drop.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
it's just, but there are. It's not always like that, but now with this album, because this album took so long, and I'm finally happy with something that I did sound wise, especially, and from the compositions, and it was an expensive album to make too, you know, because I behaved like it's 1979, and
yeah,
money is just not an object. We need a bigger studio. Yeah, we need super high ceilings. Yes. We only need analog gear.
Yeah.
We need a vintage console. Yes, of course. So, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm going all the way. I just want to share my pride with as many people as possible.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course, of course. So if people want to find you, how do they go about finding you?
MarcusDemel.com is mm-hmm. one way.
Yep.
Or triplecoilmusic.com. Okay. It's just simple, and I don't have TikTok. I have to. I'm probably too old. But I have Facebook, Instagram, YouTube.
Yeah, and the YouTube handle.
Excuse me.
Your YouTube handle, the name that you are on YouTube, is it just Marcus?
Marcus Demel official.
Okay.
Marcus Demel. Just YouTube Marcus Demel, and they will find me.
Okay.
Just. There's only 150 videos or so.
Yeah, that's that's a lot of videos.
Not compared to today's standards. I looked at Rick Beato the other day, and it says something like 3,800 videos. It's like, but that's a team of people doing that.
Oh, exactly.
I'm sure he's not editing any of it. He has a cameraman. He has a sound guy. You know,
a couple cameramen. A couple sound guys.
Yes.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Marcus. I really appreciate meeting you. And if you're ever in the U.S., I hope I get to run into you in person.
I hope so, too. I hope to get back as soon as possible, at least to the NAMM show or something. I have, so many people are writing me every day from the States, all over California, especially my own hood. I still have connections to LA, of course.
Yeah.
And it's a super important part of my upbringing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well,
so,
thank you, Marcus.
Thank you very much for your time, James.
Yes, I'm subscribing to your videos so I'll see you on a regular basis.
Thank you very much.
Talk
you take
you
care. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.